And welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of tomorrow to help you better understand the future today. Well, that's the promise anyway. My name is Martin Raymond, and this episode, we're talking all things health, wellness, and optimization with trainer to the stars, Harry Jameson. Harry, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. A lovely introduction.
I'm going to make one comment. I'm going to call out one name, Boris Johnson.
Okay. That's a punchy start. A punchy start to this podcast. Martin, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, if you operate in high level circles and work with big people and big brands, you don't stay there for very long without a bit of discretion. So I'll just say that working with people at a senior level and an executive level is, you know, where I've set my career, and I've been incredibly fortunate to cross paths with some really
the famous people. I mean, that was really the point that you had named at one point. I mean, listeners will know that you were named as the resident trainer for the current prime minister. But really, you know, I kind of was going, wow, quite an impressive thing to do. I've known you for quite a long time, and you always struck me as one of the few people, the few professionals in health, wellness and well-being who really understood what was happening in terms of, you know, the latest trends, the latest shift and changes. So I just really wanted you to talk me through some of the things you're beginning to see that might make a difference to our health tomorrow.
You know, that's the perfect entry into that question, is what will make a difference to our health tomorrow. I think we're seeing a shift from an incredibly reactive approach to health. By that, I mean sitting there waiting for things to go tragically wrong with us and then trying to kind of retrofit a solution towards a preventative health model. You know, the rise of probiotics, the rise of mindfulness, the rise of doing things that you don't see an immediate effect from tomorrow, but in the future, and you know, mentally and physically protective to our immune system and to our mental well-being, you know, has been enormous. We know that only 10% of all disease is genetic. So 90% of anything that's going to go wrong with any of us at any time is down to our lifestyle, and it is lifestyle based. So we are seeing, and will continue to see, this proactive approach to future health. Longevity will be the driver.
And it's interesting, you know, when I was thinking about this just before we came on air, I was looking at, well, the last 20 years, you know, if you think about fitness in terms of how it was defined, we were talking, you know, protein shakes, barbells, a lot of grunting. So maybe I'm thinking of Boris there, you know, grip, those kind of grip-friendly fingerless gloves. So really it was somewhat quite primitive in terms of how it used to be to versus to how we're beginning to see it now.
Incredibly. I mean, you've only got to look at the clothes that people wear. You know, I work very very closely as an ambassador of Lululemon, and they are not cheap clothes. They're incredible clothes. But, you know, what you wear to the gym now is almost as expensive as what you'd wear to a nightclub or to a restaurant. I think people, well-being is luxury. You know, the wellness and industry and the luxury industry are incredibly well intertwined. And I have fitness spaces and wellness spaces in five-star luxury hotels. And the demand for that demographic of clientele to engage in health-enhancing, longevity-enhancing, daily performance-enhancing activities and programs, of which fitness makes up a part, is enormous. You know, it's wellness is the new luxury. There's an argument to give that.
I mean, it's interesting because I was thinking about, you know, that splicing of luxury with health and wellness and well-being. And I looked at some of the trends that we have covered, certainly over the past 5 years in particular. You know, we have things like optimized health, for example, certified wellness, you know, conscious deceleration, synchronized care. So all of these kind of words and terms we created to describe what, in essence, to your point, seems to be a luxury that's about aspiration. You know, it's about certainly spending quite a lot on maintaining and monitoring your body's holistic and wellness systems, but also crucially, it was about, or is about rather, upgrading. And this notion, I think you mentioned that word earlier, longevity, you know, about upgrading the body, increasing our ability to live, but also to live well and live better and live more energetically. And I'm just wondering how you as a kind of a trainer and a coach and somebody who's written quite a lot about the sector has started marking these shifts in terms of how you deal with your particular clients.
It's interesting because the same behaviors that drive energy, and I like the fact that you referenced energy there. Energy is the real currency that we're dealing in here. You know, whether you're running a country, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're a mum or a dad or you or me, we'd like to have more energy. You know, that's the driving force, and that's driven through sleep and recovery, that's driven through nutrition, that's driven through the biological systems that drive energy within your body. And really using that as a barometer of success, you know, how much energy have I got? How good do I feel? And then to reference back to your earlier point, you know, of wellness being almost a status symbol. Jeff Bezos left Amazon, and look at him 4 months later, he's jacked. He's in incredible shape. You know, he's looking better than he looked for the whole time when he was running a big company. You know, it is a badge of honor for that demographic of people. So, you know, the aesthetics are, you know, a great part, and there's a lot of peacocking, but actually the currency is energy, and you want to engage in behaviors that drive your energy, which give you the best chance to win at whatever your daily reality is.
Interesting. So, you know, the reason I was thinking energy is currently, you know, this focus about the return to the office or not to return to the office, the debate about the, you know, we talk about the great resignation, but we also talk about the great re-engagement and how some businesses and brands are trying to get people back to the office, and how they're doing it is through, for example, you know, more recreational social spaces, bigger gyms, more swimming pools. And somebody said to me, actually, they've got it completely wrong, because what you really need to think about is energy. You know, that word that we mentioned, how you turn these buildings or these office spaces or social spaces into spaces that either generate or create energy in different ways. And they were saying that that's going to be one of the big focuses in some ways for the coaches of the future, not just about well-being, not just about health, not just about longevity, but how do I give energy, or how do I bring energy to groups and buildings? What's your thinking about that?
You know, that's fascinating to me. You know, I work in a couple of businesses and I founded a couple, and one of them is called Pillar, and we're a hospitality partnerships business, but we're also a corporate wellness provider. And we have seen, we originally were engaging with, you know, big financial institutions, banks, law firms and the like, who are big tenants of buildings. The most recent conversations we're having are from landlords who have space in their buildings that they never had before. And so how do they drive these ancillary services in to re-engage the tenants and to get people excited to come back to work, to create a premium on the, you know, on the rest of the space, on the value of the net lettable space? And it is about health, well-being, performance. You know, we have our companies called Pillar, and we provide solutions to those problems. But we provide sleep pods and meditation spaces. We provide appropriate nutrition, provide community engagement. We track through third-party APIs with the likes of Whoop and Apple Watch. So we track energy. And actually, the metric of well-being that we use is happiness. You know, I think that's the ultimate measure of well-being, which doesn't yet have a defining metric.
To do it, yeah.
And if you can define and measure one's happiness, like you could define and measure one's energy, that would be an incredibly interesting product, and one that I think that people are looking towards. It needs to have a defining metric. But to your point, the space allocation, and I use London as an example because that's where I'm from and that's where I work. There's an enormous amount of space, and they need to drive value into that space by creating energy enhancing services for the people within that space.
Interesting, because, you know, if you think about previously, and I always look to the past to give me indicators of the future or tomorrow, you know, we wouldn't be talking about fitness, we would be talking about muscle bulk, we wouldn't be talking about performance, we would have been talking about energy in terms of physical, and now it seems to be applying all of those metrics to energy in terms of, you know, mind, in terms of intellect, in terms of, to your point, personal happiness. And one of the things I noticed certainly about your new business, because you've just already mentioned it, you kind of this notion of you know, pillar being about movement, about nutrition, about recovery, is that a lot of it seems to focus more on inner health, happiness, well-being. And I think when I'd spoken to you originally, you use the word kindness. You said, if I could build kindness into any kind of you know, workout or program or how I'm defining tomorrow, that in itself would give us a new way to define this notion of, you know, performance or nutrition or recovery over the next decade. I mean, have you had more thoughts about those as you've started rolling out the business?
Yeah, very much so. You know, we place an equal emphasis on movement, recovery and nutrition. You know, we don't look at any one of those singular well-being factors as more important than the other. Gyms primarily have been fitness focused, you know, and then there are some recovery products and spaces, but they're very much kind of drop in and drop out rather than being part of your regular routine. Kindness, is it kind to allow yourself to sleep? Is it kind to take 15 minutes to breathe and to focus the breath and do some mindfulness? Is it kind to stretch your body, you know, between long journeys or long haul flights? Is it kind to feed your body sustainably sourced, you know, ethically sourced, sustainable, healthy, organic food? You know, I would say all those things are acts of self-kindness. But the result of those is optimized cognitive function. It's better fertility, better immunity, better libido. Those are actually the things that we see our clients seeking. The byproduct of doing all those things is you look better and you feel better. And that's kind of what everyone wants, right? Everyone wants to look a bit better and they're lying a bit if they don't. But really the driver for that kind of C-suite level of client is about energy and performance and all of the things that kind of longevity really is slowing the aging process. It's clinging on to your youth for a little bit longer, having the energy of a 25-year-old man when you're 65.
Oh, I know that feeling. Yeah.
Well, not just the energy, as I said, the cognitive function, the libido, the reaction times, all the things that you have when you're young. And it's very possible to keep hold of that. And we try and drive that feeling and that environment with our clients.
I mean, one of the things that has fascinated me about the whole kind of Silicon Valley, you know, the tech-secutive obsession, it has been about longevity. You know, if you think about Bezos, you think about Larry Page, Peter Thiel, I mean, all of their big conversations, and when you look at their TED lectures and the, you know, attendance at Burning Man and South by Southwest, it's all about longevity. They either want to, you know, conquer aging, or as one of them put it, we want to see aging as a disease. And if you tackle it as a disease, you believe there is a cure to it. Is it a sort of a, you know, a billionaire recognizing that their time is limited? Or do you think it's them deciding that they really want to give something back? And the big kind of holy grail is, you know, that the kind of conquering the ability to live, well, not forever, but, you know, for 150 years rather than 83.2 years.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the last 15 years of our life are very rarely the best years of our life because of the deterioration of our physical or our mental health. Now, those guys spent the first 55, 65 years of their life making themselves incredibly affluent. And then once you have the power to do whatever you want, your health is taken away. So that is why I think their focus from an individual perspective sits there. But what we also know is the same behaviors that drive longevity drive performance. The same behaviors that drive recovery mitigate the chances of chronic disease. Now, we would like somebody to live a long, happy, healthy life, but also have the energy that they need in order to kick everyone's butt, right? These guys are out there trying to alpha the alphas.
I have a friend who she wrote a book called Silicon States, which is really about how, you know, Silicon Valley is becoming almost a separate state. And she said, you know, one of the great tragedies of this whole process is that those who want to live forever, like the Jeff Bezos, the Pages, and the Peter Thiel, they're pretty dull. She goes, can you imagine another 25 years of dullness with these people? So I quite like the idea that it might be a good idea, but perhaps being blessed on the wrong people, which is really bringing me to my next question, because I know that we have quite a lot of chats about, you know, how fitness looks long term, but we also occasionally discuss those kind of fads and those things that we think, oh wow, where has that come from? And a couple of them I just wanted to repeat to you, because I've spent a weekend with people who would fit into this high network group talking about various diets and activities that they were convinced about. And I just wanted to run them past you to see what your kind of initial thoughts were. So, you know, Jack Dorsey was talking about slugging salt juice every morning, which to me sounds, you know, worse than suspicious. It sounds like, as a gay man, it's probably the thing I'd have to do for fun, but not necessarily for health. Wim Hof, you know, huffing and puffing. I've had a chat with him about swimming under ice and water and shouting and coming out, you know, glorious and big and buoyant. You know, Dave Asprey talking about, you know, lacing his coffee with butter, so you had all of this fat going into your system, so it made you intellectually more sharp and proficient. I'm just wondering, you know, those things and the many other things we could talk about, is there any good in them, or is it simply the wealthy throwing their money after anything that would just keep them happy and awake at night?
Down one by one, because they're all slightly different. And I'll start with Jack Dorsey. I used to have Twitter, were a corporate client of mine, so I used to fly in and talk to the their global offsites in New York, and would often reference Jack Dorsey, who also would go on 3 or 4 days of, you know, silent practice and not speak to anyone. He would do a prolonged fasts and would look at the benefits of long water fasts or intermittent fasts. Necking big pints of salt water is new on me. So, yeah. You know, I know he's willing to try.
It's really not pleasant at all.
It doesn't sound pleasant. You know, he's definitely on the biohacker end of the spectrum. From a Wim Hof perspective, and first of all, the fasting stuff that he does, you know, I massively believe in, and you go into all of the autophagy benefits of fasting, where your body eats away at the old dead cells, and you could live longer by employing that. Wim Hof, 100%, you know, you're driving part of your autonomic nervous system, which moves your body into physiological recovery through cold exposure. He obviously takes those things to an extreme, but if you combine breath work and extreme cold or extreme hot, i.e. saunas and ice baths, you know, massive physiological restorative effects. And we employ some of that in our business. Dave Asprey and the bulletproof.
Yeah, the butter. Bulletproof diet. Butter goblin.
Yeah, the bulletproof diet. Yeah, you know. Really what he was trying to do there was drive ketosis. You know, he was trying to kick his body into a ketogenic state in which it would use fat for energy. Now, if you were already fairly overweight and went from being incredibly sedentary to moving a little bit and then only drank high-fat coffee, by default, I would imagine that you would lose weight. You know, it's not necessarily a life choice that I would advocate, but there's a little bit – there's you know, this science that backs all of these kind of crazy fads. You know, these men made enormous amounts of money by being incredibly scientific and diligent about what they did. So there's definitely science to support that.
Yeah, you see, I love the fact because you're both very kind to them. And also, as you explained it, it makes sense. But just when I hear them talking and when I kind of listen to them, I think you're all quite bonkers and mad, you know, butter gobbling, salt slugging, hopping about in cold water pools on the mountainside. But, you know, I think I'm now convinced that this is probably something good to think about. I wanted to move on to the other areas, which they have, and a lot of the science I'm reading at the moment, you know, about future health, wellness, well-being, is areas, for example, like microdosing, you know, IV transfusion, so just kind of transfusing the entire blood system in the body, using shamanesque substances, rather. So things like ayahuasca, for example, peyote, but also CBDs. And there seems to be quite a lot of science coming through at the moment about the health benefits, the not just spiritual as well, you know, kind of physical, mental. And I think even with things like LSD, which was tested the first time in the 60s by people like Timothy Leary and that, we're now revisiting it and realizing that it can help us, or rather my question to you is, can it help us to rewire and reset our bodies in a way that's more beneficial to our overall health improvement? I mean, what's your thoughts there?
I mean, 100%. I'm a co-founder in a business called Rain, which is a wellness CBD focused business, and we create suites of products where we focus on using CBD to drive recovery, whether that's sleep optimization or stress and anxiety or anti-inflammation from a sports perspective. Nootropics are enormous, and I think mushrooms will be, in a therapeutic sense. It's very difficult to have a conversation with someone who says, you've got a CBD business, and they think it's still like smoking weed.
Yeah, of course.
There's a lot of perception. There's a big perception gap there. There's a lot of education to be done. When I talk to someone about drinking mushroom tea, they think I'm in a field at a festival tripping. That's the reason.
Chaga mushrooms as part of your diet, nutrition, stability. Yeah.
But there are a lot of other uses. We're leaning back to these ancient ways of being. The ayahuasca ceremony that you mentioned, the shamanistic type of activity, has become incredibly popular. Massive amount of wellness tourism is focused on going and having those type of outer body esque experiences. And I think as we see cannabis become more widely used outside of the THC side, so outside of the bit that gets you high, and the CBD industry is a multi-billion dollar industry now, we will see mushrooms become as normalized as that. With Rain, we had to work really hard to get visibility into spaces who otherwise would never have accepted us. We're in Selfridges, we're in Printemps in Paris, we're in Neiman Marcus in California. These super high-end department stores would never 3 years ago have accepted cannabis-based
products. I mean, so true, because we had started talking to clients, for example, alcohol clients, beauty clients, clients in the general wellness sector about CBDs probably, I guess, just under a decade ago. And certainly those more conservative clients who were already in areas like alcohol, for example, where there were lots of regulations anyway, could not envisage how CBDs could be part of the sector. And, we likely, as always, try to explain that it isn't about, recreational drugs are just getting you out of your mind. It's about things that are helping you to get back into it and recalibrate and build up a different sense of health and wellness. And I think this is where a lot of the confusion probably has come about in the market. I think CBDs have managed now to get through that doorway where people are more comfortable. I think, to your point, I think mushrooms are next. I think microdosing. So again, I see a lot of wellness, well-being, health and wellness spas, for example, beginning to look at that. And I'm just wondering, were there any other things that you had seen that might seem odd now, but if we were having this conversation in 5 years' time, it would be just, how we're monetizing it, how we're using it, how it's now become part of our kind of day-to-day beauty or wellness rituals. I mean, is there anything that you've spotted?
I think you're right when you say mushrooms. If I was going to point my finger and we were going to look as a business at what we would, like to get into next, based upon, the values and of us as a company and also knowing our consumers. These things become normalized because of the habits and wants and needs of the affluent, and then they trickle down into the mass market. So when you see the consumer demand from that demographic of people, mushrooms being a perfect example, I think you'll see a large rise in those type of products that are coming to the forefront. Huge beauty companies like Kiehl's, for example, do CBD face oil. We're seeing people starting to diversify into that space because of the anti-inflammatory properties of CBD, beyond any other. And I think we'll see a rise in tourism based upon those kind of enlightening experiences. Ayahuasca holidays are wellness tourism grows faster than any other sector within travel and has done for the last 3 years. And I think those experience, group experience led type of activities, domestic and not, from sort of coffee rituals all the way down to really deep in the forest ayahuasca ceremonies, I think we'll see resorts and places built for that
to do it. You're kind of way ahead of it, because we did a report probably a year ago looking at that in terms of what we were going, shaman, the kind of shamanist holidays where people would choose exactly that. And interestingly, we were presenting it at a conference, which is one of the big international travel and luxury conferences, for a client who I won't name for the same reason that you won't name the fact that you work with Boris Johnson. But they just asked us to take the slides out. They said, we do not want to see these things as part of our holiday wellness, well-being, you know, mind-body experience. I mean, what nonsense and what, you know, utter narrowness of focus and vision and understanding. Because to your point, exactly that's happening. And I think the big secret to the success is the ritual or the framework of, you know, safety, of journey and of story that surrounds them. And I mentioned that because I was speaking to somebody recently and said they were doing an ayahuasca ceremony and that they described. I said, oh, where are you doing it? She said, well, actually, I'm doing it in a yurt in a Clapham back garden run by a shaman who trained in Basingstoke. And I go, oh, my God, that's the problem. You know, that's where you're getting into that kind of, on one level, complete familiarity and everydayness. But actually, you're removing the thing that helps stabilize the bigger ceremony. So I just wanted to take you back to, again, to the RAIN product, because I think it fits in to this whole concept of creating ritual around you know, how we're marketing new kinds of substance, new kind of wellness techniques. And when I saw the product, you sent it to me, I was going, hang on a minute, this looked like it had been in the market for quite some time. So it was timeless. It has really beautiful quality to it. It was luxurious. So it didn't look like it came from a pipe shop in Camden or smell of patchouli oil. And also the sense that surrounded it. So both the smell of the candles, the way the pen had been designed, you know, the kind of the dispensing pen, the butter balms, etc., were so of a particular emotional and physical texture that I was quite amazed that when you told me you had created it. I mean, how long ago when you started this product? Because it really threw me when you told me it was pretty recently.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and thank you. That's exactly the look and the touch and the feel that we were going for. You know, we wanted to create a beautiful, aspirational, but accessible brand that had valid, well-credentialed products that could become part of people's, you know, wellness ecosystem, whether that's the alleviation of anxiety or stress through using our pen, whether that's the application of a balm pre or post-workout, or using a candle when people come over for dinner. And, you know, we've got some incredibly exciting products in the pipeline. But in order to build trust with your consumer, in order to build something that is, CBD was a kind of, my co-founder is a brilliant guy called Gregor Angus. He said, we need to take these products out of the bathroom and into the bar. Now, they need to come out from this little kind of shaving bag where I put a few drops under my tongue because I don't want anyone to know that I'm socially anxious, through to the point where my RAIN pen can sit on the bar next to my Apple Watch and my Apple phone and my laptop and the other and my handbag while I drink my old fashioned, and I'm proud to have it out there, and you know, and I like to talk about it, and that's only done by beautiful and innovative design. I would love to tell you I single-handedly designed all of the packaging and everything myself, but no, I'd be lying. And we've got some incredible partners and people within our team. But it was a very, very conscious decision. Almost, we knew what we were trying to achieve, but to create a brand and to trademark the word RAIN for us was definitely a challenge.
I was amazed, actually, that you got away with that, because if you think about it, it so suited the product. But I was going, wow, hasn't somebody come up with this before? It seemed almost, again, like an obvious title that fitted into the current trends and kind of captured the current zeitgeist about how we're beginning to see health and wellness products.
Yeah, you know, we're only a few years old now, and we've made some, you know, really strong headway. Like I said, you know, the Selfridges of the world, we are there, and we're trying to find our place in the market. And I think that, you know, these types of conversations are incredibly important. And I think as people start to become more aware of how important the creation of rituals are, and I'll use sleep as an example. It's probably the biggest pain point amongst any, you know, the demographic of people who we interact with, you know, from a business perspective, but also my clients as a trainer over the years, and my wife as a mother. You know, we all would like to sleep a bit better, a bit deeper, and a bit more a bit richer and wake up again. The default position is wake up with more energy. Now, if you create a system or a ritual that involves winding down properly and digitally disconnecting, taking some CBD in whatever form you enjoy to ingest, and then combining that with some mindful activity, some human connection, we're looking at mental, physical, emotional, and in some cases, spiritual well-being. So do something for each of those factors before you sleep. And then when it becomes as habitual as brushing your teeth, my God, as a business, we've done our job. But as an individual, those rituals have enhanced your life. And I think that wellness products rely on people become addicted. But wanting to be addicted in a positive way. You know, addicted to the feeling of feeling great, not addicted to the sort of negative substance side. And I think that's where people need to get their head around, you know, the nuances between mushrooms and microdosing and CBD and THC. You know, reportedly Steve Jobs microdosed for the last 20 years of his life, you know, and he had some pretty great ideas. So I think there's going to be some really interesting times ahead, and hopefully businesses like ours will pave the way for more to come behind. But there's strong education needed, and strong education needs big budgets. And I hope it doesn't end up being the same four massive businesses in the world that own everything.
They take them over. I guess that is one of the, an unfortunate side to all of these things is when you see those mass market companies coming in. So you start off with the what I call the innovator candle. You know, the first time I remember seeing people like Diptyque or Cyr Trudon at Paris do, you know, home candles in a particular way and create smells that were about burning wood or about the smell of bubbling tar or, you know, fog coming off the sea. So they're slightly conceptual ideas. And now I go to my glade and I find the smell of burning wood and stuff that really doesn't smell like burning wood. It's just really nasty and synthetic. And one of the things I wanted to kind of just hone in a bit further on is when you're looking at these things. You've mentioned sleep, which has become, you know, a big trend at the moment. You talk about, you know, the areas of microdosing. You talk about CBDs. You mentioned the whole issue of energy rather than just, you know, physical fitness and well-being. And these are the kind of things that we do as a business. So we're always looking at, you know, 3 to 5 years ahead and going, this is the trend. And then here's the opportunity for how you as a business or a brand can exploit this trend. And it always strikes me that you seem to be there at those moments when things are just bubbling through and bubbling up into the mainstream. Is that because you spend a lot of your time reading, looking, reviewing markets, or is it because your instincts are just hitting you and you're seeing something, go, that's a good idea, and then you take it to market and suddenly because it's of the zeitgeist of the moment, it becomes part of the kind of wider trend or cultural shift? I mean, how are you kind of going about your initial thinking and research and setting yourself up as one of these people who can spot trends coming through?
Well, I think, you know, it's a bit of an old adage, but, you know, luck is opportunity meeting preparation. And I think, you know, when you are well poised in an industry to take advantage of opportunities, you know, that's when you're at your best. And an example I'll use is Pillar. You know, I'd had gyms in hotels for a very long time, from the Rosewood Hotel to the Langham. And then 7 years ago, I set up a health retreat business. And we take people all over the world, from the Maldives to Italy, and I saw this kind of slightly broken ecosystem within hospitality because healthy food didn't really exist and the spa didn't know how to really drive truly restorative activities. And the gym, 80% of all gyms were unmanned. You know, they were well equipped, but they were unmanned. So no one was driving this customer journey. And I thought that would be a good idea and that people should. And as a result of which, you know, I'm fast-forwarding a little bit, but, you know, we'll be opening our first health club within a luxury hotel at the New Raffles in London. And that is a very fast-forwarded version. But I could see that problem because I was in it and I was living it and I was there. Luxury hospitality has often leaned on third parties to borrow brand equity. And I was giving a talk at a conference in Marrakesh, Pure Matter, about 6 years ago. And I said, people like me, you know, celeb trainers, quote unquote, will start to replace celebrity chefs in the hospitality world. You know, we'll start to see practitioners like myself coming in and taking ownership of spaces, just like we saw Gordon Ramsay at Claridge's or Heston Blumenthal at the Mandarin Oriental, because the consumer priority is shifting away from F&B and towards wellness. So there is an opportunity. Now, I'd love to, you know, I said it because I knew that, you know, I was going to do it, but there are many others, you know, like me globally who are really, you know, blazing a trail. And then you have an opportunity to back wellness products in behind it and create memberships, which drives the value of the residential sale component that sits next to the hospitality. So this whole ecosystem of enormous value. Now, the anchor underneath it's actually, you know, a really well-equipped gym with some really great people and some really great food and a really great spa is driving a whole destination. You know, the Old War Office at London is going to be an incredible, incredible destination. 9 restaurants and 120, you know, high-end apartments and 120-odd hotel rooms. But, you know, the foundation of its wellness, and I was positioned to move.
I mean, it is quite incredible, because I actually I'm going to be chatting to Stephen Alden later in the year. He was the new GM for the hotel. And Stephen, of course, as you will know, used to work at, again, one of the great hotels that really was game-changing in terms of its food offer and upping the standard of luxury, which was Claridge's. And I think he really probably is now thinking about how the Old War Office can become that new destination, because already you have luxury vying for the next big changing thing. And to your point, it has moved away from food, because, you know, the other problem with food is it's an hour or a 2 hour time space in our lives. You know, if we're going to this great restaurant or to see that great chef, where health sits right across it. And somebody said, you know, recently that, you know, I want to plug people in 24/7, where if I run a restaurant, because somebody's actually moved over into the wellness industry, said, I can only plug them in for 2.5-3 hours at any given time, and probably only once or twice a month because of how people will start spending their money. So really, I just wanted I'm just aware of time. If you have to think about that point you've made, you know, wellness, well-being becoming the new focus of luxury hotels, residences, hospitality generally. Are there other things that you will forecast for the next 3 to 5 years that you think will change the wider luxury sector that relates to your area or specialism? I mean, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, you know, we're looking at, and I, you know, consult personally, and I think it's the influence of design on wellness, you know, actual structural design, space design. You know, we designed some sleep rooms, for example. I designed the first sleep room in Africa, and I, again, at a different conference, I said, no hotel room has ever been designed to get a good night's sleep, which is crazy because it's a hotel room. Hotel rooms are designed to be like Vegas. You know, I don't want you to be asleep. I want you to be consuming my pay-per-view movies and my alcoholic minibar and my delivery massage or my delivery room service. Whereas actually, what will people pay a premium for? Would you pay a premium for a room that got rid of your jet lag, you know, through blackout blinds and everything from air purification to water filtration to mindfulness to circadian rhythm lighting, you know? And what about if you are somebody who would spend money on that in your own bedroom? Sustainability was the key pillar for structural, for the construction industry and for the high-end residential industry for the last 10 years, and will continue to be, and rightly so. But how does your property influence the planet, and how does that space influence your health will be a really, really interesting and key driver. You know, we're having some conversations with some incredible companies and incredible designers and architects, you know, both structurally and from an interiors perspective, about how we work in collaboration with them to tailor the design of the space from places for rituals down to the toxicity of materials that are used to how your house affects your health. And I think that is a very interesting space.
Yeah, because I remember going to, I think it was the St. Regis in Mexico City, where I actually had a technology butler. And the technology's butler job was to carry a tray of remote controls into the room and then to patiently explain to me how each of the 12 remote controls worked. And I really thought, okay, this is not going to help me to sleep or whatever. And then you had the, you know, you had the pillow maitre d' who brought in 25 pillows, and you had the feather down mattress impresario who showed you how to use the feather down mattress. And it really occurred to me, to your point, that these things were becoming so baroque and so kind of, you know, overly done that we have to get back to basics. And I think you've absolutely cracked upon it, is to bring sleep, silence, respite, the chance to reboot in a way that removes all of those things. So I'm going to grant you that that's a forecast that I'm absolutely going to believe in. Were there forecasts, because the program is called Back to the Future, in the sense that we always look at something we've got wrong and then we revisit and go, actually, you know, there was a better way of looking at it. Were there any things that you at the time said, look, it's going to be about this, and you completely... to use Boris's term, I don't know why I'm mentioning Boris here, that term, do you call it misstep? Do you make a misstep or you misspoke? What were the kind of things that you go, wow, I shouldn't have said that?
Several, but, you know, actually, you know, on the start of my, you know, journey as an entrepreneur going out to raise money, I, you know, with hindsight, the thing that we were doing, the thing that I wanted to do with my then co-founder, who's a great digital marketeer, was to, you know, we need to create a healthy hotel. This was 8-7 years ago. Now, what we were talking about was kind of the Equinox Hotel in Hudson's Yard in New York, which, you know, it was fantastic. We were lacking, you know, £250 million. So we went out and we tried to raise. Tried to raise a lot of money, but with no background in that space and, you know, no real chance of ever having any of these private equity guys giving us anything. And I remember being sort of chased out of a meeting, still firmly believing that the idea was an amazing one and you should have a hotel that catered for your health within a city so that people would come and pay a premium for less. No TVs, no electric sockets, I mean, creating this great debt. But, you know, it was young, it was foolish, it was reckless. We took loads of those ideas and I moved those into Pillar. And, you know, we now work within existing infrastructure. But at the time, when you're young and a bit cocky and you walk into a room, ask somebody for several tens of millions of pounds, and they kind of laugh you out because it's just you and your mate with a bit of a crazy idea. You know, I definitely got the level of the pitch wrong.
Sounds like just the timing. I mean, that's the thing about forecasts, isn't it? Sometimes it's not that the forecast is incorrect. It's just the timing or the context. It's like chatting to Lamborghini about, you know, the notion of an electric racing car. And to your point, the CEO, not just laughing, but actually getting quite offended that one of, you know, his kind of, he talked us up as forecasters and as people who really understood and could explain tomorrow. And as soon as you open with a slide pointing out that the future of racing is electric, you were just, to your point, asked to leave the boardroom. Just one final thing. Tomorrow, I'm not going to ask you to mention the Prime Minister's name again, but I'm going to say, what's the one word that comes to mind when you think about tomorrow or the future?
I think people often paint, you know, a bit of a sad picture about where we are as a society or a planet. You know, there's always a war going on and, you know, an incredibly sad thing happening in the moment in Ukraine and, you know, and the state of the planet. But actually, I believe it's an incredible time to be alive. I believe our lives are if you have an idea, you can take that idea and you can turn it into something unbelievable. I didn't come from a privileged background. I didn't come from a place where I was able to lean on other people to support me from a sort of financial perspective so I could just get ideas funded. But I came up with some ideas and worked with some really talented people, and those things have now come to fruition. So my number one word, I would say, is possible, because I think there's lots of possibility for both positive and negative change. But anything really is possible. And I genuinely believe if you back yourself and surround yourself with, and I have incredible business partners across all of those opportunities that we talked about. But I think it's to believe in the notion of possibility. And if you back yourself and you work incredibly hard, anything is possible.
Perfect. I have to completely agree, because I always think that, you know, the great thing about the future, it hasn't happened. And our job as forecasters, or, you know, our job as people involved with well-being, looking at opportunities to improve people's health, is to look at what's possible. And even if we fail, by looking at the possible, we get closer to success. Harry, many thanks again for speaking to us today. I mean, if you want to find out more about Harry's work, you can go to www.pillarwellbeing.com or follow him. Well, I was going to say follow him around Hyde Park while he's trying to keep up with Boris, or Boris trying to keep up with him. But you could follow him on his Instagram account, which I believe has a pretty substantial following. I was a bit shocked when I looked at it. I was going, how come you've got all those people? But then, you know, having looked at your CV and things you've been doing, I understand exactly why. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Until next time, this is Martin Raming telling you to keep looking, keep listening, and of course, keep learning and keep asking what's new and what's next.